Let's see. I just finished grading the exam, so I didn't really have a chance to run statistics on it. It felt to me like though anything over an 80 is an A. In between 60 and 80, maybe it was a B. With pluses and minuses near the borderline. Any questions about anything? I went over the exam last time, but to clear up any questions.
Yeah, I forget the second problem.
What?
I forget the second problem.
Oh.
Like, that's all I did.
If you want to turn it in, you can turn it in now if you want. I'll give it to the grader.
No, the solution has been posted.
Oh. So today I want to talk about the square drum problem. And so to make life easy, I'm going to make it a square drum of length pi. So I'll have an x and a y axis to describe the drum, and I'll make it pi by pi. And then if it's going to be a vibrating square drum membrane, the U, which is the displacement, would satisfy the wave equation. And in with two-dimensional space, the wave equation is the Laplacian on the right-hand side. So you can determine that equation by making little squares and doing Newton's law of motion on the that little patch. It's kind of a fun thing to do, but that's the kind of thing you would do in a physics or engineering class. I think Stein does derive the wave equation. It's a good thing to read, but I'm not going to do that today. Let's see, since this is a drum, it's going to be pinned down at the on the edges, on the rim of the drum. So the boundary conditions are that it's not moving on those four edges. Then, like we've been doing, using the method of separation of variables, we assume our solution can be separated into special form of function of x times function of y times function of t. There's going to be lots more solutions than just that, but we can actually find those because we can reduce it to ODE problems, which are manageable. So when I plug that into the equation, the d2u dt squared, that would pile all the derivatives onto this t function, the t derivative. So you'd get x times y times dt double prime of t. And we want that to be equal to c squared times the Laplacian of u, which is d2u dx squared plus d2u dy squared. Let's see, that would be c squared. When I put the derivatives on the x, that would give me an x double prime times y, t would just float along like constants. And then, similarly, on the y derivatives, I'd get a y double prime, and the others would float along like constants. And now I look at that for a while. Let's see. There's lots of x's, y's, and t's in spots. I get the big idea. If I divide by XYT, a lot of stuff's going to clean up. And since the T is going to be an easy side, I'll put the 1 over C squared on the T side. So let's divide. It's actually U. So U is XYT. And I'll also divide by the C squared. And when I do that, I get T double prime, 1 over C squared, divided by T, equals X double prime over X plus Y double prime over Y. And that's starting to feel like I might be able to get somewhere with that, because this side's a function of T alone, and the other side's a function of X and Y. And so, for example, if I fixed an X value and a Y value, that shows me that the left-hand side is a constant. In fact, that's all I get by doing that. And once I've realized this left-hand side is a constant, that means this thing is a constant. So we see that this, by the usual routine, this has to be a constant lambda. And so we don't have any restrictions on the T. There's no boundary conditions or anything. And so the T problem is going to be easy. It's just T double prime minus lambda C squared T is 0. That's an easy ODE to solve in all the cases of lambda. But now, so we'll save T for last. Because there's no more restrictions on T, no boundary conditions or anything. But now let's think about what we have there. We have X double prime over X. Equals lambda minus y double prime over y. Once again, we are in this situation where we got a function of x that needs to be equal to a function of y. And so the aha moment here is these both must be a different constant, mu. Because this side's a function of x, and this side, that lambda's a constant, is a function of y. And the only way that can happen is if they're both constant. And so look what I have now. I've got problems, two problems, and they're very similar. They just have different constants. So let's see. Here's the two problems now. The x problem is x double prime minus mu x equals 0. And the y problem is y double prime. Let's see, I'm going to put the minus lambda, is that right? Minus mu. No, it's going to be mu minus lambda. Mu minus lambda. Y equals 0. And if you go back to the very beginning and think about the boundary conditions that we want to hold, the boundary conditions would also require that x of 0 equals 0, that's the pin down on the left side, and x of pi needs to be 0, that's the pin down on the right side. We also need y of 0 to be equal to 0, that's the bottom, and y of pi to be equal to 0, that's the top. So the four sides lead to these four boundary conditions. This one's left, right, bottom, top. Well, those are the same old problems we run into over and over again. That's the Fourier series problem. We know that the lambdas have to be, well, let's see. In the exam we had plus lambda times that, and that only time we got interesting answers was when the plus lambda was positive. So this one we're going to need mu to be negative. And we know what we get. We need mu equals minus n squared to get solutions to this problem. And for each of those n's, we get xn of x equals sine nx. And same thing over here, except look at, this would mean we need mu minus lambda to be equal to minus m squared to get an interesting answer. And the y function, y of y, let's call it y sub m of y, is equal to, same thing, sine mx, my rather. Okay. So let's see. Oh, I got to think about this now. I've got to go back now and get my t function. I got y functions. I got x functions and y functions. And to go get the t function, I need to find my lambda. So this one gave me, this thing tells me that the mu has to be a minus n squared. This thing told me that mu minus lambda has to be a minus m squared to get meaningful non-zero solutions that satisfy the boundary conditions. And now I can figure out what lambda is. Okay, so let's see. So the aha here is lambda equals mu plus m squared. And the mu has to be, what? Lambda equals did I mess up a minus sign someplace?
I think the mu minus lambda,
I think that needs to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, sorry. I flipped it. So this is lambda minus mu. And so lambda minus mu needs to be that. And so lambda needs to be mu minus m squared. That's going to be right. And remember, mu is minus n squared, so this is minus n squared minus m squared, which I like to write as minus n squared plus m squared. And now I can get my t function. And those numbers are very interesting. Those are going to be the overtones of the drum. So my lambda is minus n squared plus m squared. And my t problem now, let's see, it was 1 over c squared t double prime over t equals lambda. And so that is going to give me t double prime plus c squared times n squared plus m squared t equals 0. And this is the t problem. This is going to be the frequencies of oscillation. And so my t solution is t equals a cosine c times the square root of n squared plus m squared t plus b sine c times the square root of n squared plus m squared t. And so, for example, let's see, this would correspond to the initial position of the membrane. And this one, the sine terms, would correspond to an initial velocity, just like we had in the vibrating string problem. So if I was going to pluck this membrane, I could take these b terms to be 0, and I'd get the initial shape, because the cosine 0 term is 1, and this one is 0. And this would give me... Yeah, so this part of the solution is for solving u of x of y at time 0 equals an initial shape. So let's call that f of xy. And this piece would be for solving the other initial condition. It's like the vibrating string problem. If I whack a piano string, I'm going to give it an initial velocity. And that comes up here. So this would be d by dt of u of xy at time 0 equals some shape. So for example, if I hit it with a drumstick, then that would make a little bulge here where the drumstick hit, and it would give it a little pulse of velocity where I gave it an initial velocity from whacking it with a stick. Anyway, the solution we get now when I add these all up, so I'll have xn's and xm's, but the t depends on both n and m. So I get basic solutions. Let's see, xn times ym times t, and t depends on both n and m. And the interesting thing, let's see, the frequencies. Let's think about solving an initial condition. So I get a bunch of solutions like that, and what we want to try now is a sum, uxyt is going to be a sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, and a sum as m goes from 1 to infinity, and then I would have an, let's see, for each one I'm going to get an anm sine nx sine my, and then that a term was the cosine. Cosine c times the square root of n squared plus m squared t. And then the bn terms, there'd be bnm's. And this would be a sine nx, sine my. And this oscillating term was sine c times the square root of n squared plus m squared t. Like that. And so, for example, if I wanted to set t equal to 0 and try to make this satisfy some initial conditions, the sine terms would go to 0. So this term wouldn't be here. The cosine terms would all be 1 there. And so if I had an initial value problem, so the last thing to always do, the initial conditions. So, for example, I'd have u of x, y at time 0. And look at this, a new kind of thing we haven't seen before. It's a sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, a sum as m goes from 1 to infinity. This is what's called a double Fourier series. It's actually a double Fourier sine series. Oops, that's an my, not an ny. And we want that to be equal to f of xy, a given shape. would want. This thing is called the double Fourier sine series. Double Fourier series. And there's different ways of thinking about it. You can think about it exactly like we've been thinking about Fourier series. These functions turn out to be orthogonal. On the square, if I integrate with respect to area. So they actually converge to the, it's possible. And so here's one way to think about it. Phi n m equals sine x sine m y are orthogonal on the square. With respect to this inner product, integrate from minus pi to pi. So I'm going to integrate minus pi to pi, minus pi to, not minus pi, 0 to pi. It's a square from 0 to pi. F of x, y, let's see, sorry. I need functions. How about g of x, y? H of xy dx dy. And if these were complex, which you, if you're going to do e to the I instead of sine in x, I'd put a conjugate there. But these are real, and they're orthogonal as real functions. But this is the standard inner product with respect to the area of a square. So you can do exactly the same routine we did back then. You can multiply this sum by sine of this one term and then integrate. When you integrate, you kill all the terms that they're orthogonal to and you spit out exactly the one where it's a perfect square, and so that one will not integrate to zero, and that'll tell you what those coefficients have to be.
Professor?
Yeah.
Wait, where did we get this new product from?
I just invented it. So when we're doing a one-dimensional string, we integrate it over the string. When we're doing a two-dimensional square drum, we integrate over the square.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is an area integral with respect to area over the square.
Okay.
And sure enough, when you integrate these things, you do an iterated integral. You integrate the sine terms. Those are orthogonal when you integrate dx. And then when you integrate dy, you've got these terms which are orthogonal. So it's a very easy calculation to see they're orthogonal. And so, you do the usual routine. You multiply by phi and m and integrate over the square. And when you do that, you'll get on one side, you'll get the integral minus pi. 0 to pi. Let's see, here you get sine nx. I'll put the f. On the right-hand side, I had f of xy, and then I'd have sine nx, sine my, dx dy. And all the other terms, when I integrate this big mess, the big sum, would integrate to zero except the one. And the one that would pop out would be anm. And then I would have the integral of that thing squared. Sine squared nx, sine squared my, dx dy. And that's easy to calculate. What is it? It's pi over 2 squared. Yeah, so this is easy to calculate. You just do the, you get pi over 2 times pi over 2. And so you get pi squared over 4. And so that lets me calculate my coefficients in the sum. My ANMs would be 4 over pi squared times this integral. And so I could actually crank those out. That's what ANM has to be. Okay, so you just do it. And now if I wanted to do the other initial condition, I'm not going to write it out, but it'll be the same concept. I would write du dt at xy 0. Then the cosine terms become sine when you differentiate, and they would be 0. And that would allow you to solve so that there are no an terms. And you get the BNM terms by exactly the same considerations. So you need them both if you're going to solve a real problem with a drumstick hit. But what I wanted to say here today was the frequencies of the overtones. When I did a vibrating string, I got that beautiful series of overtones, which are very musical. It was basically a C major scale of a chord, E, G, C, etc. And it sounded very musical. And so when you pluck a string, you hear music. But the overtones of a square drum the frequencies are the square root of n squared plus m squared. And those, remember, the frequencies were all divisible by each other, or multiples in the musical case, the string. And so it sounded musical. But these are very discordant. If I played these notes, I couldn't play them on my horn because they wouldn't be there. The fundamental pitch would be there, maybe, but then the rest of them would be very discordant with the fundamental. So when you hit a square drum, it sounds more like a clank than a musical sound. They're discordant with the fundamental. So it's not a musical tone at all. And interesting, let's see, the pitch of the string was the lowest one was the pitch of the string, and those other ones were usually smaller, the coefficients are smaller, and that's why they're called overtones. They're much milder, and the pitch you hear is the big first order term. So the pitch of the drum is the lowest one. The lowest in the sense of music, which is the square root of 1 plus 1 squared plus 1 squared. That's the smallest that number gets. That's the slowest vibration. Actually, the frequencies were C times that. And so that's the pitch of the drum. And those other frequencies are discordant with that basic pitch. It's kind of a fun thing to do. We did the isoparametric inequality. You could ask, this is a drum here. What would happen if I were to do a rectangle? Well, let's see. Remember that day I showed you the vibrating drum with the beautiful picture in maple? There were certain lines that didn't move when you do that. So these modes of oscillation, the modes of oscillation. Let's see, for example, if I looked at sine 2x times sine 3y, the sine 2x would have this thing down the middle where that line wouldn't move. And the sine 3y would have two lines down the middle where it didn't move. So have you ever seen, what's it called? These are called nodal lines. If you ever look in your coffee and while it's sitting on a microwave and vibrating, you'll see this pattern of lines. Those are the nodal lines where these basic functions would have sets where they don't move, and there'd be standing waves going up and down in each of these little cells. These are called nodal lines. Nodal curves. They don't have to be lines. They're where these basic modes of oscillation leave you fixed, and you have standing waves, these little humps going up and down inside each of these little cells. Well, what's an interesting thing, in the vibrating string problem, this never happened. But now that we have these frequencies, it's possible to have two of these things add up and be the same thing, give you the same number. So, what am I thinking of here? Let's think about when that could possibly happen. I lost my notes here. Oh yeah, nodal lines. Yeah, 65, for example, is equal to n squared plus m squared in multiple different ways. In fact, in more than two ways. So I can write, for that case, I could write all those frequencies adding up, and I'd get these sines and cosines things, and I would get a much more interesting set of nodal lines, curves. They wouldn't be straight lines anymore. They'd be something more interesting. And if you ever wanted to see these things, get yourself a square drum head and hook up a little vibrator thing and excite it. And if, as you excite it with certain frequencies, you'll see that the nodal lines pop up. In the beginning, you get these really simple-looking square patterns. But then as you got into the higher frequencies and you got the right frequency that made this one get excited, you could excite it in different ways and see totally different nodal lines, and they'd be more interesting to look at than just these little rectangular grids. In fact, it's a good thing to YouTube. There's lots of YouTube videos out there where they excite something to find out the... to isolate these modes of oscillation, and you excite them in different ways, you get different modes, and the nodal lines can be pretty striking and beautiful. In a coffee cup, they're more beautiful than this rectangular thing, but interesting things start happening real quick. There's a famous problem that I can talk about now.
With like fixed point theorem?
The nodal lines are fixed points, but it has to do with the differential geometry of what are called eigenfunctions of the Laplacian. And that's what I'm going to talk about now. A famous problem is, can you hear the shape of a drum? If I were to do this problem for the spherical drum, or a circular drum, I'd get different eigenvalues, totally different. But for a square drum, can I hear the shape of a drum? I get the square root of n squared plus n squared. Those are called eigenvalues. So these phi nms that I wrote down are called eigenfunctions. For the Laplacian. And let's see, I think I would have here Laplacian of my phi n m is a lambda times phi n m. And what's the lambda? Let's see, would it be n squared plus m squared? Yeah, when I differentiate twice, n squared and m squareds would come out. So in fact, the constant is n squared plus m squared. These are called eigenfunctions, and this is the eigenvalue.
And every shape would have a unique sequence of these things. And so somebody asked, well, do those numbers determine the shape of the drum head? And that was a big question for a long time, and it was answered in the negative. They don't determine it. You can have two crazy-looking drum heads that would have the same sequence, and they'd be different. They're not terribly different. They're sort of jumbled up remixes of each other, so they look related. But it was a big problem to solve, and it was solved quite recently, that no, you cannot hear the shape of a drum. I think there's a fact, though, that if these... it's like the isoparametric inequality. If these numbers are the numbers of a circular drum, then it has to be a circular drum. Otherwise, they're not uniquely determined. Things like that. Pretty interesting stuff. Another fun thing to consider is, what if I take a rectangular drum? It's just slightly more work, but it's the same work, so I won't repeat it. A rectangular drum. Let's see, the rectangular drum would give me exactly the same thing, and I'd get my U of XYT would be a sum as N and M go from 1 to infinity. Let's see, I would get A N M. The X1s would be N pi X over A. So this would be the length would be A and B. And this would be sine M pi Y over B. But then the big thing is you get cosine C, and these would be pi over a squared plus pi over b squared, the frequencies, t. And then you get the one with the sine terms. And those are interesting frequencies. You look at them and they're different than the square drum. And they're totally different because you got A and a B in the denominator, so you get a totally different sequence of numbers. And an interesting question to answer is, among all drums of a fixed area, which one is the lowest? So here's a little problem. Among drums with area A, which one is the lowest? Which is the lowest pitch? And you could guess, especially if you had little rectangular drums to whack, you would think, can you guess the answer?
I guess they have to be rectangular.
Well, they are rectangular. Oh, yeah, sorry. Rectangular drums. A circular drum is more pretty than a square drum, but it's still kind of a clunk rather than a sound.
Seems like a longer one.
Mm. Those get kind of like xylophones, and they actually have a higher pitch. Because, the 1 over A... You see, you got the 1 over the A there, and those get big really fast when A is small. So that would make those big numbers, which means high frequency. So if you start playing around and thinking about that, the answer is the square drum is the lowest one. And you could actually figure that out. Let's see here. The lowest frequency would be... Where's my pi? Oh, yeah, it would be C times pi times the square root of 1 over A squared plus 1 over B squared. And let's see, if I was going to write those in terms of the area is equal to A times B. So this frequency, let's call it F.
I could write F as C pi times the square root of 1 over a squared plus a squared over a squared. So then I get a function of one variable. My area is a constant, fixed. And so I eliminated b this way. And now I've got a function of one variable and I can do calculus to figure out what the lowest one is. So I'd graph that thing right there and find out that the lowest one happens right here, and that's at the square root of a. This is the a direction. And that's the frequency. And so the lowest one happens when a is the square root of a. And b, of course, would have to be the square root of a. That's kind of fun. And you can see that, you know, if you make your rectangle really long and skinny, then that lowest frequency starts getting real high. Yeah. Oh, I put homework on the homepage, and I decided not to make it due until the Monday after spring break. So it's a week from the Monday after spring break. 5 problems. The usual thing. Any questions about anything?
How far are we going to go in
stuff? Well, let's see. I want to do the Weyl's fact about equidistribution. That's a fun thing to do. That's in chapter 4 after isoperimetric. And I figure after I do that, then I want to start doing the Fourier integral, Fourier transform, because that's really important. So we don't have that many weeks left to do it, but I figure I'll get some of the most important facts about the Fourier integral, the Fourier transform. Yeah, so we'll get to chapter 5, definitely. We might not get too far through chapter 5. But the first order of business when we get back will be to the Weyl equidistribution theorem. It's a fascinating thing about if you want to generate random numbers, this is how they really do it, based on this fact that Hermann Weyl showed. It'll be fun. Okay, this feels like a good place to stop before break. So did anybody not get their paper?
I didn't miss the center.
No, the problem 4. I think the disk was convex, so I want to use the usual line join them. I forgot to miss the center. But it's not a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a question about the exam here? So here I had this one problem. I said maybe like average value being 0, and not even 0, it must be positive somewhere, negative somewhere. And you had a note here that I already showed it must always be positive, always negative.
Right, that's
good. But that was my entire point, because I just said it's just proven.
Oh.
So I showed that it must be always positive, always negative, and then I showed sort of by different reasoning that it must be positive somewhere and negative somewhere, and then that's a contradiction.
Oh, okay, so I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
So that's an easier way of saying it.
Yeah, I guess it wasn't as clear as it could have been, but that's what
okay.
I was saying. Yeah.
Okay.
So my entire point was that there was a contradiction.
Okay, let me take this back and change here. Can I keep this?
Sure.
Or maybe I'll just write myself a message.
It's just 3 points. Right?
Yeah, I'm going to add those back. I'll go change yours. I put your score in Blackboard, so I'll change it back. I'll write myself a note to do that right now.
Okay.
Have a good break.